Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing business. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Bruce McPherson. He's the publisher of the eponymous McPherson & Company and an old friend. Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Hi, David. I'm great.
Good. Well, it's good to talk to you today. We're at a particular moment in time where you've gained a certain amount of public recognition for publishing Jamie Gordon's Lord of Misrule and winning the National Book Award. And that's partially why I wanted to talk to you, but it's also, it creates an interesting story because you've been publishing for more than 35 years. And I wanted to talk to you about, first, maybe you could talk a little bit about the history of McPherson and the antecedent entity that you began with, and just how you what got you interested in being a publisher?
Good starting point. Although I'm not exactly sure the precise starting point, because in high school I edited the school newspaper, even though it's a very small school and a very small and infrequent newspaper, and that probably first got me interested in journalism, along with the fact that I had three absolutely superb English teachers in high school who were really challenging me and my classmates to read Faulkner and Joyce and a number of other figures that I don't think were necessarily part of the normal curriculum in high school. And I really got into it, even though I never thought I was going to pursue any sort of literary career in publishing. At that time, in fact, I was headed to become an engineer originally. And I got a little bit sidetracked once again by a professor when I was at Brown University as a freshman. And I had a course in comic literature with a guy named Roger Hinkle, very funny, very smart guy. And I was the lone freshman in an upperclassman course, and had a delightful time. I thought, well, I would continue taking the odd English course amidst my engineering curriculum, and I found myself less and less interested in engineering and much more interested in English literature as that year went on. And the following year I took a poetry course with a poet named James Chaville, who was had come east from San Francisco and was part of the San Francisco Renaissance, I suppose, with Kenneth Rexroth and Robert Duncan and others. And brought a special, and Gary Snyder, and he brought a special kind of laid-back, interesting take on modern poetry, and I took a modern poetry class with him, and there was this other person in the class named Jamie Gordon, who I, just immediately in the class recognized as someone who had an uncommon spirit, an uncommon mind, an intellect that I was utterly attracted to, and we became friends outside of class, and part of that friendship resulted in because she was a graduate student taking this class, and was in a creative writing program, a Master of Arts program that was run through the English department, and in those days, I think maybe still. Perhaps to get a creative writing degree, you had to take a number of straight courses, in English literature, and so that's what led her to that particular course and her interest in poetry. But she also was in touch with a guy named John Climo, who had rescued a literary press there was a student-run organization, and she introduced me to him. That press was called Hellcoal Press, and it had been founded a few years earlier in the late 60s by two guys named Steve Heller and Chris Cole, the name, but the metaphor was so striking and apt for, you know, a funky small press being run at a university that I was fascinated and attracted to it, and I got sucked in, and within a year I was the managing editor under Claymo, and then a year later I was the editor. And part of that involved my insisting that that Jamie Gordon also be part at least of a literary annual that we edited called Helco Annual. And also we published a lot of little chapbooks and small anthologies that included student work and work from all over the country, wherever it came from. And we fancied ourselves as being a real small press. That is, we sent copies of our books to Gotham Bookmart in New York City and City Lights and Grolier Bookshop up in Cambridge. And so we fantasized that we were part of the literary scene, which was burgeoning with small presses at that time of every description and every quality. And we thought we would be part of the dialogue. I'm sure we never got paid a cent for any of the stuff that we sent out, but that wasn't the point either. The point was to really get involved and get things out. But understand, you know, these were usually staple-bound, mimeographed, or at best, you know, offset, cheaply offset productions that were done in, you know, at most 1,000 copies, but usually, you know, 250 copies or 300 copies.
Right, and I should maybe intersect there or intercede that that was really, you're talking about the early 1970s,
yeah.
And it was really a period when all over America, people, young people primarily, were picking up on the fact that they had easy access to cheap technology that would enable them to publish into an, you know, kind of a cultural movement almost,
right,
that was going on at that time. So, you know, I think you were definitely part of that spirit, and, you know, you were one of the, you know, as you said, there were hundreds of people doing it, but of course you've continued. But anyway, sorry for the interruption.
No. I'm glad you brought up that point. You know, I often, you know, I would even point out that the literary component was only perhaps a quarter or a third of that movement, because there was a political component, the anti-war movement and various other movements, including early or nascent environmental movement, and then, of course, the feminist movement. And all of these fed into and had representation from various independent publishing entities that sprang up and withered away, you know, with startling frequency.
Right, although there were some that are still around, and then there were also, there was also the part of the Black liberation, Black power movement,
yes, indeed,
and Native American identity.
Right.
There's,
right,
you know, many, we can probably go on, but
right,
there were some few of that era survived for longer than a few years.
Right. Well, yeah.
But not that many.
Well, and I never intended to, because after Hellcore Press, I graduated and you know, I lucked out. I was given a job. I was working for the school, the university, for a couple of years, and living cheaply on my own. And I had a little spare cash. And by this time, Jamie had finished her first novel in manuscript, and it had been her thesis for her master's, and it was called Champ of the City Solo. And that book made some of the rounds in New York and Boston publishing houses, and was even sponsored by William Goyen, if you remember him from that time, a noted novelist and also former editor in various places in New York, and it got nowhere. And so finding myself with a little cash, a little experience, a lot of naivete, but you know, the general feeling that if we could go ahead and publish this book in a small edition, we could insert it into the turn into a little bit of an underground phenomenon, and then that would launch her literary career, and then I would be free to go off and pursue whatever other things I was interested in. I never imagined that I was beginning a career. But that is what we did in 1974. We brought out the book in a small edition of 1,000 copies, I think, in various forms, hardcover, paperback, and limited edition, and created this press that I called, or we called Treacle Press, and we did actually have a little bit of a hit. I think part of the attention that we managed at that time was due to the fact that very few small presses were publishing full-length novels. They were mostly doing poetry or much shorter books. There were a few, but not many, that were doing full-length fiction. So anyway, we got some attention, abraded the sensibilities of some of the establishment, which we considered the red badge of courage, and I fully expected that Jamie's, that the book would then take off, go somewhere big, and it didn't. Not that it stalled her. In fact, I think it pushed her forward in some ways, and once we'd had so much fun doing this, I just couldn't imagine not continuing. So the following year, I did a book by Clayton Eshelman, who had kindly offered me a small book of poems and directed me to an artist in New York named Nora Jaffe. And so I was, 21 or 22, and I went down to New York and met an absolutely amazing artist who offered to do drawings, a suite of drawings for the book, and that established another friendship. I mean, I mentioned that really just as indicative to how the bonds of friendship develop in the literary world for small publishers and among poets and writers and artists and filmmakers and others. It's an extensive and community that is fundamental to the continuation of the work of almost everybody. No one creates, in absentia, or in some sort of mythical province of their own.
No, and in fact, I think that what you're describing is a key feature of literary publishing and small independent publishing in general, whether it's literary or political or whatever, is there's an element of the social involved in it, and that is that the relationships between, and of course I think this is true of commercial publishing on the level of editor to author, but particularly for literary publishers, you see the relationships become critical because it isn't about making a lot of money, it's about doing some working in the milieu of trying to make public work that you believe in. And that puts you in a direct relationship with the creators, whether they're writers or artists or whomever it is you're working with. And I think that becomes almost a definition of how the best independent publishers operate. The strength of the vision of the editor and publisher has to match the vision and work of the writers in not just in the physical sense but in this kind of relationship way.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And obviously, if you look at you've published now, how many books would you say? It's maybe more than 160 or something.
Not quite so many, I think. Maybe 140, maybe 150.
It's a lot of books, though. Yeah. And but you've got, you have not published thousands of books. So, that the you have relationships, you personally have a direct relationship with every book you've published. and that's kind of definitional. And that you know, if you look at the, you know, you can probably tell a story about every book, either the author in relationship to you or in some other way, what got you interested in that work. And I'm presuming you have a relationship with every book that's pretty deep and meaningful.
I think that's true. How many programs can I appear on?
Yeah, I know. That is, I thought about that. We can't cover the entire history of 35 years in 30 minutes. Obviously.
No, I'm gonna have to speed it up, obviously.
but I do want to talk a little bit about how, you know, as this evolved from being a fairly small, you know, press in the early 70s where you're doing a few books, and, you know, during that period, you know, we can sort of talk as about the, you know, the, you fit into this arc of a larger picture, which is, you know, that independent bookstores were also beginning to increase in number in the 70s, so that by, you know, the 80s, there were literally hundreds, if not thousands, of outlets who bookstores that would carry books that were highly literate and unusual, such as the books that you've published.
Yeah.
But then, you know, as we go further along, those bookstores have clearly declined. And so, you know, presumably over these years, you have adapted your distribution and sales structure to adapt to what has changed in the marketplace. Because for you to still be here and still be selling books, you must have adjusted. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about how you see it, how it has been different from, you know, the early period of your publishing to now. I mean, also, you've evolved. I think that, you know, your books are beautiful and really well produced, but, you know, they've been that way for a really long time. And the authors you publish are serious and important literarily, but you've been doing that for a long time. So the real interesting point, I think, is to, you know, look at what you have done to figure out how to commercially survive.
Hmm. Yeah, that, you know, I wish I could say I had always pursued an intelligent strategy, that I had been able to perceive the marketplace and know exactly how to fit in.
Well, no, I mean, that would be really great if you had done that.
But in fact, you know, it's been a trial and error from the very beginning. And I have... I've always played this this game, if it is a game, from the edges or from the outside, because I haven't been able to enter into the mainstream. You know, I've always been in the tributaries, and by that I mean even when I tried to let's say distribute through, well, it's one of the early presses for Consortium. And I stayed with them for maybe a year, because I just, which I guess we should explain to people, is a book distribution company that focuses on independent publishers, and this goes back a long way before the present incarnation of the Consortium, which does a fabulous job and handles probably 100 presses or more. And but in at that time there were only four, there were commission representatives who would go around bookstores, and my books have always been quirkier. Not exactly easy sells into the marketplace. So my experience with working through the conventional distribution mechanisms of distributors and wholesalers, and where you put out a large number of books into bookstores and try to drum up some interest nationally, or just really didn't quite work with most of my stuff. Even when I would get a big review, in the New York Times or something like that. Still, my audience would be dedicated but small. And so I've had I pulled back from attempting, you might say, to publish nationally, or to be a broadcast publisher. I was never a commercial publisher, but to go instead as a kind of narrow casting publisher, you know, to try to find the audience and develop the audience. And one of the ways of my publishing, or one of the principles of my publishing, has been somewhat old-fashioned in that I believe that I'm publishing authors, not books. The distinction being that I will stick with an author and continue to work with an author over a long period of time to try to build a career and go book by book, developing that audience. And each of my distribution efforts, and there have been a variety, have been predicated on the notion that I have a relatively small audience for most of my books, but that I can reach them sometimes through bookstores, but that the audience also includes a direct component, you know, people who will respond to mail order catalogs. And another part of the audience is libraries, in particular university libraries. That another component of my distribution would be to distribute through a distributor in England to find that part of my audience that you know is residing there. All of these are sort of, you know, part of my division of, you know, the means of distribution, you know, that I would go after each of these, but rely on none of them.
Right. Now, but does that mean, from a practical, and I think this makes sense, you know, obviously, if you publish within a certain aesthetic boundary, that what you say is literally true, and that is you can identify an audience for the type of books that you publish, but that requires on your part, you know, there's some practical issues. You have to maintain contact with them. You have to, it means you're doing mailings, you know, whether it's print mailings or emailings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to really work hard to communicate with your audience, and presumably they communicate with you. So it obviously, there's a lot of work involved in doing this.
Yeah, and when they don't communicate with you, that's another message.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think that would give you, you know, that says, okay, this book maybe didn't even appeal to my core audience.
Yeah.
But so now, given, let's say we're, you know, we'll sort of skip to the present time. So as you describe it, this means that you have some bookstores that buy books from you, you have some libraries and, you know, the intermediary wholesalers that fulfill their orders,
mm-hmm.
And you have direct business with individual readers.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you sell to Amazon because I know I can find your books there.
Right.
Do you ship out of your house? Do you have a warehouse somewhere? How do you manage the logistics of physically supplying books to all of these different entities?
Well, I guess I have to admit that I ship out of my house. I mean, I have a fairly large basement and it's chock full of books. But for the most part, you know, I print small quantities.
Right.
People were shocked, I think, when there was an article right after the nomination of Lord of this rule for the National Book Award that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, because you know, some savvy guy from the Wall Street Journal called me up and said, well, now what do you do? You know, I assume you're so small, you're faced with a big problem. You know, how many books do you print? And I said, that's exactly right. You know, I mean, I don't know, because normally I print, you know, a couple thousand, and that's often the extent of a publication. Now, most people would, you know, kind of be shocked by that, but in fact, most books are published in quantities of under 5,000 copies. I mean, the vast majority of all books that appear.
Well, actually,
from all publishers.
In fact, if I know some people in commercial publishing who have said to me that the numbers actually have changed radically over the last few years. And there are many, many books that are being published in very small initial printings.
Yeah.
And being small now is we're getting down to the numbers that independent publishers are used to.
Right.
Which, I mean, I think there used to be a pretty big distinction between an independently published book of fiction and a commercially published book of fiction. You know, you might print 2,000. It might be that, you know, a Grove might print 4 or 5, and a Random House might even print 10 or, you know, so, or even more. And I think those numbers are now coming to a sort of stasis. You know, there's a kind of equalization process
right.
going on because the market has changed.
But it's shocking.
Well, I think in a way it is, but, you know, I think if you think, you know, the question is, you know, how many readers are there for serious fiction?
Yeah.
We don't know. I mean, obviously there's a lot of competition for readers. But you've picked out some certain territories of, you know, that you've worked in continuously for this period. You know, maybe some of the, you know, and also you've maybe increased the audiences for some of the writers that you've published. But now, in the other, I guess the other component of your business that's important to you is foreign rights sales. That I assume this is a central to your economics.
Well, more recently it has been, but I should mention something else too that has been central to my economics, and that is that I've had a couple. I do nonfiction as well. Mostly literary nonfiction, but I've made some forays into ethnographic studies. And in particular, back in the early 80s, when I was being transformed from Treacle Press, or transforming myself from Treacle Press, and then I had added an art imprint called Document Texts to do sort of avant-garde books. Books on avant-garde art of a documentary sort, and it did not fit under the rubric of Treacle Press. Well, in the early 80s, I renamed the whole operation McPherson and Company, and I had been urged since the late 70s to bring a book back into print that had fallen out of print and had even been, to a certain extent, pirated. And that's a book called Divine Horsemen, The Living Gods of Haiti by Maya Deren.
Right, I know that book. I remember that book.
And that book, I initially thought, well, I knew who Maya Deren was because I knew Stan Brakhage, and he was an American filmmaker, extraordinaire, an avant-garde filmmaker, and Deren had been highly influential, a friend of his, and back in the 50s, And earlier in the 40s, she had been given a Fulbright, I think, to go to Haiti to film dances, and had become completely enraptured and taken in by the Haitian culture, and came back, and working with, under the tutelage of Joseph Campbell, had written a book that is a very extraordinary ethnographic and comparative religious study of Haitian voodoo, and as well as a book that incorporates her own personal encounter with voodoo, and so it's certainly not simply an academic. It's a very scholarly book, but it's written with the eye of an artist, the ear of a poet. And with a great high spirit as well, and it has survived since its earliest publication with Thames and Hudson in 1949 or 52, I believe, when Thames and Hudson, the publishers, actually were located both in London and New York, and. Anyway, the estate of Maya Deren came to me and begged me to take on that book, and I at first refused and said I think there are other publishers that would be better for it, and it doesn't seem to quite fit my list. But a couple of years later, they came back, and I, you know, had read the book and loved the book, and said, "Well, why not? You know, I mean, this must be a sign." So I published the book right at the time that I was redesignating myself McPherson and Company, and got some renewed notice for the book. And the book has been a mainstay for the press. No, it's never been huge, but any time you have a backlist book that sort of regularly sells 1,000 copies a year,
yeah, it's pretty good.
You are relieved of an enormous burden, and I have a couple of books like that. So having that as the basis, I've been able to, you know, and it's been reasonably reliable. I've been able to continue to also take chances on the books that I really am not certain I'll ever find an audience, but I believe absolutely need to be made to appear. And it is true at the same time that I have been interested in and making an effort to sell the foreign rights of my books overseas for the last 25 years or so. I've been to Frankfurt for I think at least 25 years, and that goes back to even the first time I went over, which was about 1978, when I was trying to sell the arrange a European edition of Carolee Schneeman's book More Than Meet Joy about her performance art. But and I'm afraid that was unsuccessful in one sense, although it certainly raised her the awareness of a lot of people of her work. But in recent years, I have had much more success selling rights to my books, in particular a book called Beneath a Marble Sky by John Shores. As you say, every book there is a story or maybe several stories, and that's one that has several and has now gone into about 15 languages and launched a career for a very, very bright and ambitious writer who is located in Colorado and has really carved a career for himself.
Let's talk a little bit about what's happening now, because obviously this is something that's on your mind right now, I know, and that is with, you know, the unusual success, you know, commercial and kind of public awareness of McPherson and of Jamie for Lord of Misrule. This puts you in a difficult position in some ways, because your structure is built a certain way, and you have to figure out how to adapt. And you have, as you said, decisions about print runs that are on a different scale. I mean, it's not like, you know, in a way, it's just a magnification of what you've done in the past, how many books to print. You try to figure out what the circumstances are and figure out how many copies to print based on what you project ahead. It's just you have a bigger problem now because the numbers are bigger. But do you think, will this, does this create a challenge for you in terms of how does McPherson and Company maintain its equilibrium? Because you know, you have this one kind of unusual event occur. Obviously it's going to make you some money and enable you to do other things, but, you know, what's on your mind about that right now?
Well, it's thrown off the publication schedule for several books, you know, it certainly caused me to wonder whether, exactly how I'm going to find enough time to devote to those books, because they were, very, very tightly planned. One book that was going to be appearing this month in December, I put to the end of January, and I think that's going to be all right. There's another book, for example, that I still want very much to come out in April, which is a translation of a Chilean novelist book, about the post Allende era, and I'm hoping will be launched at the time of the Penn World Voices Festival in New York City. You're sort of facing more constraints of time, I have more ability, you know, financially perhaps. So, you know, there's always a lag time. So it looks as though you're making money, but as a publisher, you're never even quite sure you're making money until a sort of not quite final, but at least a good running accounting can be taken. In the case of Law of Misrule, you know, I thought I was being almost brash when I bumped up the press run of my, you know, pre-nomination press run of 2,000 a few days later to 8,000, and that seemed like an awful lot of books to me. The day after it won, it seemed like an awfully small number of books, and 2 days after we won, I found myself doing something I never imagined I'd have to do, or be in a position of doing, or of having to figure out how to do. And, you know, I'm very grateful to an understanding and enthusiastic printer who made it possible for me to print 25,000 copies and get them out 6 days later.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, actually. I think it deserves some, you know, some attention. The publisher did a great job. I mean, the printer did a great job
yeah.
for you.
Yeah, it really went way beyond my expectations. And if they hadn't, we would be, in a sense, having another conversation, because I'd still be wringing my hands. The books wouldn't have yet left. I wouldn't know exactly what was going on. The books shipped the day before Thanksgiving all over the place, and this entire past week they have been hitting both warehouses and evaporating instantly. It's a strange phenomenon to see that happen. You know, I'm seeing sales figures that I never imagined before. I mean, I could imagine them because they're normal. You know, this is a normal, everyday sort of experience and mode of operation for commercial houses who are dealing with bestsellers. But I never imagine I'd be in that position. I'm able to see, you know, this phenomenon of the great publishing and promotion machine at full work, full throttle, in terms of the newspapers, the other media, the wholesalers, and the way Amazon has been promoting and handling this. For which I, by the way, have mixed feelings. I mean, you know, and Amazon makes a few pennies from the sale of one of these books in order to capture as much of the direct market as they possibly can, so that people will buy other things when they come onto the website. But the effect is, of course, that it makes a competition with independent booksellers, who are my first love, you know, extremely difficult. You know, there are ways, perhaps, in which they find to promote, and certainly they've been able to, you know, hometown hero bookstores have been able to do extremely well. But I'm still yet to figure out exactly how well we're doing in, you know, the basic small literary bookstores, such as they are.
Well, I think, you know, in some ways it's easy to say, but I think it's a good problem to have. And I think, you know, as long as you maintain your equilibrium, and that is to not change what you do too much, I think that you'll be fine. I think that it's difficult to deal with, you know, the kind of the large swings of the pendulum that you get with big books like this. You know, large printings, which means, you know, no matter how well it does, there's always going to be returns. But I think that, you know, as long as you don't change the essential identity of McPherson and Company, which I'm sure you're not going to do. I think you'll manage this. I think you'll be fine.
Well, thanks. I may consult with you later about how to weather some of these storms. I look forward to. I have experienced for the last 20 days some things that have just been a real challenge, and they've been relentless. Just in terms of the number of demands or requests from other people, or the requirements in order to keep the whole thing going, which has been exhilarating but also exhausting, and I'm really kind of looking forward to it all quieting down again so that I can get some of the other work done.
I think actually you can count on that happening because it's the nature of kind of contemporary culture to have these huge swings. The huge attention paid to a particular cultural event or a book or a movie, and then of course they're on to the next thing. So the cultural ADD is in your favor here.
Right. That's and also I get to pass on the book because it's going to be coming out in paperback in the spring to another publisher, and it's maintaining it or keeping that ball rolling along becomes their responsibility more than mine.
Right.
At a certain point.
Well, that makes sense. I think I do think that is a. I think you've made the right choice there, because it's just so difficult to be as you have been called, a micro publisher. I don't think you're really that micro, but by comparison to somebody who's publishing 1,000 titles a year, there's just a different infrastructure in place. Well, Bruce, it's been great talking to you. I think we probably could have gone a lot longer, but we've reached the end point for this conversation, and maybe we'll have another one at another time.
Okay. Well, thank you, David. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Bruce. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and I've been talking to Bruce McPherson of McPherson & Company, the publisher, who can be found at McPherson. What is the web address?
McPhersonCo.com.
Thank you. I blanked out there. McPherson.co. And I do recommend a visit to the website. Thanks so much.